by two lawyers that I know, and they don't have a lot of experience in medical malpractice, but I would expect them both. And they put their personal savings accounts and an awful lot of their effort and time. They lost the case. Came from around the United States to help them defend it. And the plaintiff simply got outgunned. And that's a major problem. We haven't been listening to that, our side of the problem. So we have an awful lot of people with deserving claims. And we get outgunned by the high quality of defense and the unlimited amount of money the insurance company has to pay. And also, of course, our society still puts doctors on pedestal, and I think rightly so. But it makes it awful tough for a person able to deserve a case to be successful.
Well, the only thing I want to say is I
could
was
we, led could you inter- excuse me, sir, could you introduce yourself for the record? Thank you.
I was led to believe that I was going in for 3 days in the hospital. And they were going up through my groin with a catheter to put some dye in my neck so they could see where my blood vessels were blocked. They never got a catheter past the aorta, and they tried 3 different catheters. And they never did perform any operation. And all the plaque that was in there, my veins, went down into my legs. And the arrangements that were supposed to be made with 3 doctors was not arranged. So the 3rd doctor was not there at the time. So I laid there for a long time. And then when they come, all of my arteries in my legs were plugged and they couldn't do anything about it. Instead of being in the hospital for 3 days, I was in the hospital for 40 days. And even then, they didn't know whether I'd live or die. And then after I got through, the doctor I'd been going to for many years, he didn't even want to see me. That's it.
Could we have your name, his name?
Huh?
What is your name, sir?
My name is Edward J. Clark.
Thank you. It's nice
of
you to be here today.
I've lived in Salem about 35 years.
Thank you for coming here today.
I'd like to introduce to the committee my client, Mr. Rod Peterson. This is a young man for whom I can't think of anybody I have more admiration for in this world. This is not a medical malpractice case, but it'd also be affected by this bill. Rod was trying out for the varsity football team at Benson High School, and he was 15 years old at the time. And the coach decided to have live scrimmages on the first day of practice, which is a violation of every rule that's been written, except it isn't applied in Oregon by our OSAA. And he was coached into and led into doing a head tackle with his head down. And on the second tackle with his head down, he impacted against the fullback's thigh. The fullback weighed about 40 pounds more than Rod did. He broke his neck and severed his spinal cord. And we brought the case. Of course, the school district had a limited liability of only $100,000. They paid that. We brought the case against the Oregon School Activities. And we got a judgment for a little over $1 million. But Rod, what would you like to say to the committee?
Well, my name is Rod Peterson. And I would just like to say that the money that, you know, people that suffer injuries have mine should be justifiable for the reason that people try to achieve the highest level of independence they can. And when you suffer something as catastrophic as injury as I have, your level of independence is lower. Because I have to depend on a person every day for the rest of my life to do simple things as tie my tie to tie my shoes. And in order for me to try to achieve a higher level of independence, I need to get the proper education. And for me, that will take more money than the average person. I need special transportation. I have special needs. And that's what my money goes towards, is for me to try to get the best education I can so someday I can have a family and provide for them in the way that I see fit. Thank you.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you for spending the afternoon here with us.
I made a promise I wouldn't ask her to testify about her husband, my client, Joe Richmond. And I'm embarrassed and ashamed to tell you that I represented Joe. He had a case following a coronary bypass surgery. There were complications, and then about 6 weeks later that were not recognized. Finally, fluid accumulated around his heart, gradually squeezing his heart off till it couldn't, the circulation stopped. By the time it was recognized, his heart was decompensated. He was taken to the operating room. He had a cardiac arrest. His brain damage. He was 44 years old, a successful businessman. This is an all-American, all-Oregon family. He has two fine children. He's successfully educated, has a long-term marriage. Joe can't walk, can't talk, can't do anything for himself. Taking care of Joe is a full-time job. If he were to go into an institution where he would receive proper care, it would be about $4,000 a month. But his wife, of course, is taking care of him because she's been devoted to him for now about 30 years, and it's a full-time job for her. He has very limited economic damages. It would be limited to the $100,000, I suppose, under this bill.
And one more set of clients. Nancy left.
There was a little baby here, and she was crying. She wasn't really a little baby. She's about 4.5 years old. And this is an obstetrical case that I thought you would be interested in seeing. Jessica is a spastic quadriplegia. She cannot do anything purposefully. In addition to that, she has impaired hearing and impaired eyesight. Her case is now pending in court. She too probably has no economic loss. And yet if we are unsuccessful in this case, statistics show that most families do not forever bear this burden of taking care of these little children in their home. They do not have the financial resources to place them in a good institution, which costs maybe $4,000 a month. They end up in our state institution, Fairview, which is so terrible that they're thinking about shutting it down. And the little children that go to Fairview don't live very long. Stafford is Jessica's dad.
Mr. Hazlett, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Stafford Hazlett. The last name is spelled H-A-Z-E-L-E-T-T. My daughter Jessica was born almost 4 years ago. You saw her sitting back here in her specially designed wheelchair that is designed so that we can take care of her at home, transport her from place to place. A large share of the expense of that chair was paid by Blue Cross. Jessica was getting weekly physical therapy through the Oregon Health Sciences University. The portion that was not paid by Blue Cross was absorbed by the university and the taxpayers. Jessica is now old enough to be eligible for services under the Early Intervention Services Program. The services provided through that are grossly inadequate to deal with her problems, but it is what the legislature decided will be done in terms of public funding to avoid the costs of Public Law 94-142 for children under the age of 5. Jessica's level of physical therapy under this change dropped from 1 hour a week to about 1 hour a month because that's the funding that was provided. We have obtained volunteer services for the kind of physical therapy necessary to address my daughter's problems. We have, at the present, 40 people leave their families for about an hour and a half a week each to come to our house and do physical therapy and sensory stimulation exercises with her. These services we couldn't pay for, no matter how much money we had. She's showing some signs of improvement as a result of it, even though the doctors tell us that this therapy can't possibly work and is a waste of our time. We reached the point where we discovered we were going to have to make a claim for Jessica's future medical costs when we were told by some doctors who faced us squarely with the problems Jessica has, how much money the doctors expect to make off Jessica's problems for the rest of her life. The estimate of her lifespan is from the unknown up to 1 year more, or with the recent advances in medical science, that she has no reason not to live a full, normal 77-year life for a female born in 1981. A neighbor has a child with similar disabilities. That family has other children, and they're emotionally unable to care for their child. The child has been made a ward of the state. The hospital where she's being taken care of charges the state $35,000 for the year 1984. If the provisions for attorney's fees that I read in the bill were enacted, given the expected medical costs for my daughter, the care and medical costs alone, not counting educational costs, other societal costs of taking care of my daughter in terms of things like tax credits and special services for education and mental health department, comes to well over $2 million. If the damages for non-economic loss were limited to $100,000, once the attorney's fee is subtracted from that, assuming that there is a settlement or a court award for the full amount of my daughter's expected medical costs, any amount over $700,000 in the award, there will be no money for medical costs beyond that time. The formula for figuring the attorney's fee will absorb the entire non-economic loss award. Just before my daughter was born, she was fine. Someone made some mistakes. We're very sorry about that. We're very sorry for the pain that it has caused them, because they've had to recognize their mistakes. We hope it does not impair their ability to care for other people and provide good service. But we don't think the cost a future service for my daughter should have to come out of people who didn't have anything to do with it. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what my daughter's problems are. Mr. Noble mentioned she has spastic quadriplegia. 80% of her brain was destroyed by the accident. According to CAT scan imaging, she has approximately 20% of her brain left. All of the tissue appeared to be still there, but was dying rapidly when her first brain scan was done. As a result of the loss of brain mass, she has an uncontrollable seizure disorder. You didn't see any of her large seizures here today because medications keep most of the large ones from breaking through. On EEGs, they show up about twice a minute. This interferes with her ability to pay attention to anything when we're trying to reach into her or when she's trying to get something out to us. She has outward seizures between 3 and 30 times a day, in which her whole body shakes. She is unable to swallow properly and easily. Her eyes don't work together, and the vision is impaired. She went through an initial period when her heart, her lungs, her kidneys, and her liver were impaired. Those have resolved. She will probably never talk. She will probably never walk. She will probably never gain sufficient control or understanding of her body that even if she could find a way to communicate with us, that she could become toilet trained. If anything happens to my wife or to me that impaired either of us, we would not be able to continue her care, and the cost of her care would fall to someone else, probably the taxpayers of the state. At this point, my daughter's medical bills have come to about $30,000. We have paid less than $6,000 in premiums, and we have added approximately $5,000 of our own money to that. The economic impact to the other ratepayers, to Blue Cross, is approximately $19,000 at this point. My daughter will be 4 at the end of this month. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We are going to take a 10-minute recess and then come back and finish our work. Subcommittee, I'll come back to order, please. We have a few more witnesses, and I'd like to finish the hearing on House Bill 2980. Mr. Foote, Mr. Kahn, and Mr. Wabrock.
Ms. Clark requested.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's correct. Ms. Catherine Clark, please.
Thank you.
Almost forgot.
I'm Catherine Clark. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been in practice since 1979. For a period of time, I was doing medical malpractice litigation, and during that time, I was privileged enough to be able to represent Mr. Edward Clark, whom you already heard from earlier. I am now primarily doing appellate law. In 2 minutes or less, recognizing the time constraints, I would like to address briefly the issues, the Oregon constitutional issues raised by the proposed limitation of the damages award for non-economic losses. There are primarily two provisions that give rise to some concern. Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution, providing a remedy by due course of law for every injury done in to person, property, or reputation. And Article 1, Section 20, no law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally apply to all citizens, our equal protection clause. The majority of jurisdictions responding to an alleged crisis in medical malpractice insurance have passed laws which restrict damages for medical malpractice victims. Not one quite so general as the one proposed here. And a majority of jurisdictions, the courts in those jurisdictions, have held them unconstitutional. Those jurisdictions are New Hampshire, North Dakota, Florida, Illinois, Texas, Idaho, and Ohio. Those that have not held them unconstitutional, that have upheld these statutes, including Indiana and California, have applied a less rigorous standard of judicial review to equal protection challenges than is applied by the Oregon court and then has been applied by the other courts. I'll get to that in a minute. They also do not have a parallel, or at least most of them do not, to Article 1, Section 10. It's been rather vividly pointed out that some of these people who are injured will not have adequate compensation for the damages done to them, so that the effect of this is to restrict or take away a remedy. The courts, in permitting such legislation to occur, have required a quid pro quo. The classic example is workers' compensation. You could take away the worker's right to sue for his full damages, and in return, you replaced that with a timely and efficient, no-fault system of recovery. At least you took away fault. Likewise, you can take away a remedy for libel if you replace its equivalent, or replace it with its equivalent, and they have held that a retraction can be the equivalent, so that unless you plead and prove a demand for a retraction when none was given, you don't recover for ordinary negligence, and that survived scrutiny. As Indiana pointed out in denying the, as Illinois pointed out in upholding a constitutional challenge to one of these statutes, there is no quid pro quo given here. Your only quid pro quo, the only substitute that you are giving, is a benefit to society as a whole, and the court simply held that's not going to pass muster. You're not giving this victim back anything to replace what you have taken away. Secondly, we have the equal protection problem. There are two standards which probably would be applied. Assuming that this isn't a suspect class or one of those that gets strict scrutiny, we have two standards the courts apply. California and Indiana applied one of them. That is there any rational basis for this legislation? It's very easy to pass that constitutional test, although I would note that a couple of jurisdictions wouldn't even permit these statutes to meet that standard. Oregon has indicated approval of a more rigorous standard and a constitutional challenge to such litigation, to such legislation. A classification must be reasonable, not arbitrary, and must rest upon some ground of difference having a fair and substantial relation to the object of the legislation. The California statute, as pointed out in dissent by Chief Justice Byrd, would not have met this standard of scrutiny. And it was there that the dissension in the court arose. Three justices wanted to apply that standard, not the rational basis test. Recognizing that Oregon might apply that standard and that this legislation would not pass muster, the OMA response has seemingly been to generalize the effect of it so that you don't have it applying simply to malpractice tort victims, but to all bodily injury tort victims. I would point out that the problem with this is that where is the substantial relationship now at all? In fact, where is the rational basis? If the goal of the legislation is to cut malpractice insurance premiums, we have now generalized far beyond that. And where is the substantial relationship between cutting off the remedies for the victim of a burn from a gasoline explosion to cutting malpractice insurance premiums? There are two kinds of distinctions made or classifications made by the statute between personal injury tort victims and other tort victims who are not restricted in any remedy. Or that is bodily injury, mind you. The statute is restricted to bodily injury. And the poor plaintiff versus the rich plaintiff, and I'm going to briefly say something about that. The poor plaintiff who has a subsistence level income and is compensated for his economic losses if he can't continue his occupation will receive a small amount of money, but the rich plaintiff who had a far higher income and would have been able out of that to put money aside for the frivolous, to compensate him for what he's not able to do, the pleasures he doesn't have, is going to have a far greater degree of compensation. That distinction again, that classification between plaintiffs and what they receive, will not pass this constitutional muster. Finally, I would like to point out the time involved in testing these constitutional issues. Assuming a bill of this nature were passed, it's going to be some time before a case arises. Not all cases, after all, have non-economic losses that would exceed the $100,000. Sometime before a case arises where the limitation would apply, that case is going to then be litigated below. It's going to go through the Court of Appeals. I would estimate that probably 2 years below if it goes all the way to trial. That's fairly standard, at least in Multnomah County, 1.5 to 2 years. Because of the nature of the constitutional challenges that are going to be raised, that would put it, let's see, into, by the way, into 88 before we get to the Court of Appeals. We can plan on at least 18 months at the Court of Appeals. That is fairly average by the time you get the briefs written, the arguments, and have it taken under advisement. 18 months, perhaps 2 years, putting it to 1990 before a Court of Appeals decision is rendered, and there will be an inevitable review by the Oregon Supreme Court on this question. Putting it probably into 1992 before the constitutionality of this legislation is determined, and before any effect could therefore be had, even if one were possible, on malpractice insurance premiums. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Clerk.
My name is Jeff Foote. I'm a practicing trial lawyer in Portland. I'm also on the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Along with Mr. Kahn, are one of two state delegates to the American Trial Lawyers Association. I want to speak very briefly in the perspective of a practicing attorney representing injured victims on what is now Section 3 of the amended bill. This is the section dealing with attorney's fees. What the provision essentially does is limit attorney's fees or fees in a contingent situation, that is where the attorney has paid his fees out of the recovery. The scale is 35% for the first 100,000 recovered, 25% for the next 100, 10% for any portion exceeding $200,000. I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the contingent fee system. It is for the person on a limited income, his ticket to the courthouse and his ticket to the judicial system. If you take a case where you're going to be receiving a recovery, where the damages are such that a recovery is likely to be in excess of $200,000, you're talking about a substantial investment of both time and cash by the attorney. It is not unusual in a medical malpractice case to see out-of-pocket costs. These are checks that the attorney writes to doctors, to expert witnesses, to for travel, for whatever, to exceed $20,000, $25,000. In a situation like that, it represents a substantial risk. The attorney is not paid for his time until and unless there is a recovery. So there's, again, a substantial risk that the attorney is taking on behalf of his client. It is only through an attorney, a trial lawyer, who will take this kind of risk on behalf of a client that most injured victims in our society have any hope or any opportunity for redress. They simply cannot afford to walk into an attorney's office and pay the kind of an hourly rate to get the quality of attorney that they would need to prosecute one of these difficult claims. Comparison, I suppose, would be to look to see what attorneys on the other side are earning, those representing the insurance companies, on an hourly basis or on a per case basis, on a monthly, weekly basis, or whatever, however they're paid. It's simply impossible for the injured victim to get into the courthouse unless they have an attorney willing to take a claim on this basis. If you restrict the ability of that client and that attorney to reach an agreement, a contract on how they're going to determine the fees, you're going to find situations similar to what's developing in California now, where attorneys, qualified attorneys in the medical malpractice area, are not taking the claims. They're not pursuing the cases because they simply can't.